Good morning, good morning. This is your host, Dr. Terry Mason, the show, The Doctor in the House. And it's heard every Sunday right here at AM 1690 WVO and the Talk of Chicago, the Talk of the Nation. Got another great show for you. This is our first Sunday of the month. And it's always brought to you by the University of Illinois Cancer Center. And we've got a great guest for you today. We're going to be talking about what can we do about the early detection of cancer and what are the tools that are being developed to do that. So joining me on the show is Dr. Amin Salyuddin. Good morning, Dr. Salyuddin.
Hi, good morning, Dr. Mason. Great to be with you.
And if I mispronounce your name, I apologize. Did I pronounce it properly?
You got it just right. Thank you.
Salyuddin?
Yes, sir.
Good. Well, Dr. Salyuddin, thank you so much for being on the show. And what I want to do first is let the listeners know just a little bit about you and how you got to what you're doing and how you got there.
Sure. Yeah, thank you so much again for having me on the show, and good morning. So I've been in Chicago for the past 5 years. I'm an oncologist and a physician scientist, and what I'm really interested in doing at UIC in my research and clinical practice is really trying to understand how we can detect cancers as early as possible, and what are the unique ways we can, I guess, leverage to treat them or eliminate them and maybe even prevent them. And over the past, 5 years in Chicago, I've actually been working part-time at UIC, recently came on full-time to pursue this. And before I became full-time, actually this past month, I was actually working in the startup scene here in Chicago at a company called Tempus AI, where I was a scientific director, and really being exposed to all the new emergences and technologies, as well as artificial intelligence in how to diagnose people better, find better precision oncology treatments for them. And that was really eye-opening for me. And while I was doing that, I was also still seeing patients one day a week here at UIC, and really getting a sense of the Chicago population, which is, very unique and very different from what I trained on, because I was in the West Coast and in the Bay Area at Stanford to learn oncology and cancer biology. And in many ways, I think a lot of what I've learned about in the past 5 years in Chicago actually sort of dovetailed with a lot of the things I grew up with in where I grew up with, which is in Mississippi, in the Jackson metro area, so just down 55. And so it's been really rewarding and interesting, and I'm really excited to talk about some of the new things that we are able to offer to the community here. And I think that hopefully in 5 years, and I'm telling this to all my patients, we will probably have a way to really help people inform, you know, what their risk is for cancer and probably really have a good way to treat them early. And I think that's going to be really amazing and exciting, especially for someone like me who's been in the cancer field for over 10 years. Let's talk a bit about what some of these things are for our audience. You know, you're talking about markers, you're talking about some things in the blood, something. What are the things that you're working on, and what do they have in the role of trying to discern or find cancers early? Mm-hmm. So I would say one of the biggest things we learned about and really started to appreciate, and I'm speaking about the field in general, is that the cells in our body, the normal cells as well as cancer cells, when they die, they actually shed the DNA that's inside of them, right, the genetic material. And it's shed in a very particular pattern and manner that we actually now have been able to capture that from a sample of blood and analyze that. And that analysis really is done using really powerful DNA sequencing technologies and computer algorithms. And that finding, which is almost, I think, 10 to 15 years old now.
Because most of the people will not know what a computer algorithm is, a sequencing technology. So
no problem.
In a much more customer friendly way, how would you describe those things and how they impact what you're doing? Sorry for interrupting.
No problem. Yeah. So because cancer cells are able to shed out DNA in specific patterns, we now are able to capture them and analyze them in the laboratory. And now we can tell the difference between cancer specific DNA in a sample of blood versus normal, you know, just DNA in a sample of blood. Matter of fact, some of your listeners may have even had a pregnancy recently in the family where they were able to tell very early on if it was a boy or a girl just by drawing blood from the mom. And that's because the same principle is you can detect the baby's DNA different from the mom's DNA based on the size of the DNA fragments in the blood. So taking that simple principle, we know what's cancer or we know what's a different DNA than what's normal. We can now look at the patterns of the size of the DNA molecules, what their content is, and other types of patterns that happens on the DNA. And that allows us to say, this is this sample of blood has a signal of cancer or a signal of some other disease process. And that's really become really honed really well over the last 5 years. And now it's something that people are starting to explore with actual patients in the clinic as opposed to just test tubes in the lab.
How reliable is this or not?
So in my personal opinion, I think that if you are to take, let's say, a general test, right, and say it's going to look at one or two specific things, and you know those two specific things are reliable, this is something that I would offer, and I actually do that for my patients who already have cancer. In fact, in a couple of things in other types of healthcare settings, people use this type of technology to help understand if, let's say, a woman carrying a baby has Down syndrome or not, and that's very reliable as a way to do that. The alternative would be to look for, let's say, a sample of tissue and biopsy that tissue. And in many ways, that's not really a good idea. So when you're now talking about a couple of things, let's say I'm out testing for Downs or I have this patient with, let's say, lung cancer, and I want to look for a specific DNA event, that's extremely reliable. But today we want to say, can we take that technology and look at it broadly across all types of cancers that are possible in somebody? You're a normal person, you're coming in, you're over the age of 50, you're interested in saying, doctor, I want to make sure that I cover all my bases and see if I have cancer in my body or not, right? And that is something we are still evaluating and seeing how reliable it is. And that's actually why I'm on this program today to talk about the research we're doing at UIC with the Pathfinder 2 study.
Let's go right ahead and get right to it.
Sure. So, essentially, the technology we're evaluating as part of this clinical study is the ability to take a healthy person and draw a sample of their blood and run a commercialized diagnostic test called the GRAIL test, the Galleri test. And the purpose of the study is to see if we took several hundred patients here in Chicago and ran this test for them. This is part of a research study where they're consented and they have to participate voluntarily. We would then run the test and share the results with them of whether or not they have cancer. And we would then proceed to evaluate them to see, did the blood test actually perform as reliably as we hope it is? So we draw blood in somebody who's healthy and doesn't have any signs of cancer. And within 30 days, we get a result that we share with the patient saying, yes, we were able to say that there was no cancer detected, so you're pretty much don't have to worry about, I think, other than your regular health concerns. Or we anticipate about 1 in 300 or probably 1 in 1,000 patients, but sometimes we will get a result saying cancer signal was detected. And then we will help them go and try to diagnose that. So there's interesting test here we're looking at today is called the Galleri test, and it can not only say there's cancer present in the body, but it can also tell you where it could be coming from, let's say the breast, the colon, or another part of the body. And then we're going to see if that test is indeed reliable and go see if we can actually diagnose that cancer early. And to my knowledge, this is the only place in Chicago at UIC where we're actually able to offer this study, and we're very interested in seeing how our population, including African Americans and Latino men, especially since there's higher rates of cancer in our populations there, how this will actually pan out, how reliable it is.
And so for those people who come and have this test done, and I'm going to ask you, forgive me, two situations. One, when the signal or a test is, for lack of a better word, negative, versus one where the test is positive. In other words, the signal was found. What information do you give them, and how reliable is that information?
Yeah. So the reliability is something we're trying to explore and validate. This test has been evaluated before, especially in the United Kingdom, where it was performed in the National Health Services. And the test is pretty specific in terms of being able to say a negative result. In other words, no cancer signal detected. It's pretty reliable in that sense. And what we're trying to do here is, you know, not only confirm that, but also see in our population in Chicago, especially the ones I mentioned before, does that performance carry forward, right? We want to make sure that we include our patients and their specific genetic backgrounds and lifestyle modifications on potentially some of their health and see how this performs. So scenario one, as you said, we want to make sure that if we draw the blood and there's no cancer signal detected, this person would then be able to go about their normal healthcare maintenance and move forward. So a scenario could be, let's say, I have a 60-year-old female patient coming in as a volunteer consented to the study. We would, you know, fill out a questionnaire, draw the blood, and return the results of the test within 30 days. Person would then fill out another questionnaire, and that test is negative, meaning there's no cancer signal detected. Well, that person's near the age of 60. They may have other, you know, cancer screening things they need to do anyway, right? So recommended guidelines for somebody at that age as a woman would be annual mammograms and then colonoscopies once every 10 years. So we would make sure that the person, you know, still adheres to those recommended guidelines and hope that that negative results based on the questionnaire would give that person peace of mind, because that is something I think would be of good value. So any questions about that, Dr. Mace, before I go to the other scenario?
No, I think that gets it, because the question, what we're talking about now is how reliable is that test? If it says it's positive, how reliable is that? And how differently do you screen if the test comes up negative or something in between where it's inconclusive? Or is there such a kind of category?
To my knowledge, and based on the assay is run, it is not returning an inconclusive result. Typically, if you do have an inconclusive result, that's not really a scenario where they would report that. That would most likely be, in most testing these days, they would just say the sample is insufficient. Please retest. And I haven't come across that situation so far in this study. So I think we can just keep the scenario simple as no cancer signal detected versus cancer detected. So in the second scenario, let's say this person would come in and they've had their annual mammogram or had their recent colonoscopy and they're clean on those ends. And they decided to participate in the study because the study actually does screen for around 21 cancers, including those that don't have screening tests available, right? Things like pancreatic cancer and ovarian cancer. And they get the blood test, and then the result returns cancer signal detected. And it will actually tell you a couple of ways, a couple of areas that the cancer may be coming from. And that's the unique thing about this type of a test, is that it can, based on the DNA pattern, the signal in the blood, it can actually say most likely came from the lung or a different part of the body. So I'll just say in this situation, somebody has a test and it comes back, says lung likely detected. And in that situation, we actually would then either at UI Cancer Center or with either the patient's primary doctors, we would then work with them to make sure that they get the appropriate medical diagnostic tests. These are standard tests that are available, imaging, ultrasound, CT scans, MRIs, to evaluate that part of the body. And what I've read about in the literature so far is on the previous studies done using the same Galleri test is that about half the time they're able to, a third to about half the time they're able to diagnose the patient with an early stage cancer. And the remainder of the time, they're not able to find the exact cancer signal, and then the person then has to, you know, get annual surveillance thereafter to kind of figure out, is this signal really reliable and true, or was it a false positive? And that's, I think, a critical reason why, Dr. Mason, we have to do this research, because it's important to understand the impact of that second scenario where the cancer does give a result back, but we can't detect the cancer using conventional methods. So then we're in a situation where there's something in the blood that says there's cancer in the body, but we don't exactly know where it is. And we have to balance that scenario with the scenario where we actually caught a cancer early in someone and potentially saved their life. Because as we all know, catching cancer early versus when it's late and when it's spread, it's a very big difference in being able to cure it.
You know, it would seem that if one in the previous scenario that you outlined, where someone got a positive signal, that, you know, obviously, and then they couldn't find anything, that would provoke a lot of anxiety for that particular patient. How do you manage that for them?
And I think this is why we have to do this. We have to do this research study. So part of it is talking to the patients and recruiting voluntary participants, and then doing these questionnaires and talking to them, and as well as their primary care docs, about how they feel before and how they feel after the test. And I think these types of things, it's not just a new thing that we're encountering. I'm sure you've had a lot of patients, especially, you know, as a urologist, right, and prostate cancer specialist, you've had a lot of patients in your experience get PSA testing. And I, you know, as an oncologist, I've had a lot of patients come in with a lot of scans that say suspicious findings, but we don't know if it's cancer for sure. You know, those are things I think we've been grappling with for a while in the medical field. But I think here You know, is this going to be more of the same or is it going to be a bit worse? These are things we're trying to understand with the research.
Well, I think, you know, it's important because people, anyone would like to know earlier because the axiom is that if you find it early, then you have better treatment options available for you as opposed to finding it late. So what's been the experience thus far, both locally and nationally, with the concordance with the test? In other words, you find a cancer signal and then you find a cancer. What does that look like?
Yeah, so there's a technical term which we call the positive predictive value. What that really means is, you know, out of the people who test positive, how many of them actually are legitimately positive, or how, you know, is it true positive or false positive? So that's actually not too different from early, so other tests. So like things like mammograms or CT scans of the lung. So it's about across the board, it ranges from disease, but we're talking about 20 to 30%. And there's a lot of fine granular detail of this in the scientific literature. And we'd be happy to discuss this with people who actually are interested in learning about the study. And I'm happy to provide a number for that for any of your listeners. But this is kind of where we are. It's, I think, if you think about this one test or other tests like it that are able to look at different cancers, it is not going to be absolutely perfect in the setting of a positive. The reason why is there's a lot of reasons. One is we generally in screening, right, you want to capture as many people as you can, even though there are going to be some false positives, because the scenario you want to avoid is missing somebody out, right? Somebody who actually has cancer, but for the sake of accuracy, we miss out on some people who are, who actually have cancer, but whatever reason, they don't quite meet the testing threshold. So it's a little bit of a technical discussion here, Dr. Mason, but in the interest of making sure we capture everybody who has cancer, we are going to be getting some people who may either have a fleeting cancer in the body that's getting wiped out by the immune system, or maybe we're just flagging people as false positives because we're trying to capture everyone who actually has true cancer. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Well, you know, the thing is, what we're saying is that the test is far from perfect. And that's why you're doing it, to learn what you can from the best populations you can to sort of identify that. Now, the test is done how? Is it just a simple blood test, or how does the test done?
Yeah, and this is where I think it's really, I feel like it could change things. So even if the test is, as you said, far from perfect, it is a simple blood draw. And because of the technology, the way to look at the blood and profile it and return the results, it can be done within a month. And that is hopefully something that in a world, maybe in the future, you get your annual, I guess, physical and your cholesterol and your, I guess, diabetes screening done. And you could be getting your cancer screening done. And I think that is something where, for a patient, you know, I've given blood many times. It's a temporary inconvenience, but it's nothing like going through, I guess, you know, painful procedures, you know, like a mammogram or you know, colonoscopy, which are uncomfortable. I shouldn't say the word painful. And those are things where you have to kind of, you know, take a day off, right? Sometimes from work, especially a colonoscopy. And that's why we're trying to, you know, figure out ways to make this as routine as possible.
Yeah, I should say, for the benefit of, and actually for someone who's had all their colonoscopies, in fact, the last one I just had, since I'm over 70 now, doctor said, mm-hmm. Okay, he said you had a negative colonoscopy at 50, another negative at 60, and another negative at 70. I won't need to see you anymore. And I think that's one of the things that is encouraging to a patient, but it'd be even more encouraging, let's say if I, at 80, decided to come in and take your test, you know, just mm-hmm. to see. where because that gives you more information too. And I don't know if we have any callers, but if we do, we'll take our. If anyone has a question, now is the time because we want to make sure we give the doctor time to answer your questions. But this is a fascinating thing, and I think you characterized it right, very properly. It's a test. We're learning. And, you know, a negative, probably not 100% is a negative, not 100% true for negative, and a positive is not 100% true for a positive. How do you characterize for that conversation someone who comes in and has a negative test, no signals? What do you tell that person?
I would say that this test is really tuned to capture as many people as possible. So a negative result is encouraging, but I would not change anything for your regular health maintenance. And I would still make sure to go and get whatever's appropriate cancer screening tests. So if it was a woman, I'd say, please keep doing your mammograms, cervical cancer screening, colonoscopy, et cetera. You know, for a man, I'd say continue to see, get your colonoscopy and, you know, have discussions with your other doctors if you need to be screened for, let's say, prostate cancer or something. I would also, if people have lifestyle habits, I would say that, well, just because this test says something negative right now, it doesn't mean you should stop thinking about quitting smoking, for example, or taking care of your health, losing weight, et cetera. So I would say that, we don't see anything now, and I would keep doing what you're doing to take care of your health. I wouldn't, change anything at the moment. So,
I think that's very important, and we've got some callers now who would have some questions for you. Do you mind taking a few?
Sure, absolutely.
All right, caller, you're on the air with your question. Go right ahead.
Hey, hello? Dr. Mason.
Yes, sir.
Dr. Mason.
Yes, sir.
I have a question for the doctor. Actually, I'm a patient at his hospital. I was diagnosed with cancer 2014, and it's been clear to now, and it seems like it's they're saying that it's coming, it's going up. It's a blessing to talk to this gentleman to see what if I'm doing all the right things, or should I come in to see him? Because I just got the diagnosis last week that it is a couple of spots, and I need to go to chemo. And if there's any way not to, I would love it.
All right, well, I think you got two or three things we're talking about here, so let's sort of tease them out. So you already have a positive diagnosis. Is that correct?
That's correct.
You're not going to tell us what it is. And you want to know, is there a role for what this doctor's offering and having you in your follow-up process? Well, go let him get a chance to answer. Go right ahead, Doc.
A second opinion.
Sure. I think, first of all, I appreciate you calling in and sharing with us your experience. I would first say, that is concerning to hear about, things coming back. That's something you never want to hear. And honestly, if I were in your shoes, being almost 10 years out from your diagnosis, it's been, 2024, this is something you never want to see, right?
Right.
So I would encourage you to keep seeing your doctor. And then this specific study is looking for people who don't have active cancer, but this technology is actually still being used in people in your situation where it can help understand if the cancer is effectively going away with the new treatment. So that's a different thing. It can help understand, yes, I have cancer in my body. They can see it on a scan. We started a treatment. And after the treatment, the tumor is shrinking. But is it going away completely? Has it been completely eliminated? That can actually be done with your current oncologist. They can actually order these tests. It wouldn't be part of a study. These are actually currently offered by a lot of diagnostic labs, and I think that would be my recommendation. And you know, certainly, if you're a patient in the UI system, you can send me a my chart, and you know, I'd be happy to talk more in depth with you and try to figure stuff out with your docs.
Okay.
So thank you very much for the call, sir. And we'll be praying for you to have a very, very continued recovery with your situation. We'll take our next caller. You're on the air with the question. Go right ahead.
My name is Chris. I'm 79 years old. I've been a vegetarian for 51 years, but I smoked marijuana for 35 years. I have COPD. Would I be a subject for your investigation?
Yeah, thanks for your question, Chris. And yeah, actually, we are enrolling people actually over the age of 80. So I'd be happy to get you connected. You know, Dr. Mason, I think if you don't mind, I can give them a phone number for all your listeners.
Absolutely, let's put the number out. Go right ahead.
Okay, sure. So the number is 773-273-9452. So
okay,
again,
you want to say that again? A little slower?
Sure. 773-273-9452.
Okay. I've got that number. And I'll be giving you a call Monday morning.
All right. Looking forward to it. Thank you, Mr. Chris.
All right.
Thank you so much, brother. Thank you for sharing with that. That's so important. Let's go on to our next caller. You're on the air with your question. Go right ahead.
Thanks for taking my call, Dr. Mason. I wanted to ask the doctor a question about a test called a CEA, which is a carcinoma embryonic antigen test. If you take that test, like for an insurance policy that shows up on an insurance policy exam, if the numbers are high, is that a conclusive test? Because I asked my primary doctor that question. He says he doesn't agree with the CEA if they show an elevated marker for a tumor that possibly could be cancerous. They said if you got a benign condition, the CEA can also be elevated. Could you kind of comment on that?
Sure, I'd be happy to. And actually, this is one of the reasons why I think the types of screening tests today are so much different from the screening tests of almost 30 years ago. So as you said, the carcinoid embryonic antigen, that is a protein molecule that's expressed on a lot of different tissues in the body, including cancers like colon cancer, even lung cancer. And in people who have a true diagnosis of cancer, of colon cancer, for example, the CEA is often measured during the course of their treatment to see if that number is going down as the cancer is being killed off by surgery or chemotherapy. But in a healthy person, there have been a lot of studies done, especially while I was in medical school and before that, trying to look at it. But the problem with the CEA, as you mentioned, is it can be made by regular tissues or benign processes in the body. So that's why the current tests right now, Galleri, and there's a lot of other companies with their tests as well, those are very specific, meaning they know the DNA molecules that are shed by cancer cells, and that's much more unique than the CEA test. So if I was actually in your situation and you had something like that blood test, I would probably consider my options for age-appropriate, you know, cancer screening and talk that through with your doctor. If you're interested in seeing whether or not you're eligible for this study, assuming you don't have cancer in your body, I would actually encourage you to call and see whether or not you'd be interested in this test, this research study, because We're looking for participants who are interested in getting blood screening for cancers. And it seems like you've taken the plunge already and taken the test. So a lot of the anxiety that Dr. Mason mentioned earlier may not be as much of an issue for you. And I would at least hope that a test that's been tuned to capture as many people as possible and basically have as low false negatives as possible, if you get that result, maybe that will actually help you put your mind at ease about the CEA results, because the CEA is a little bit more imperfect than what we've seen so far with these types of DNA tests.
Right. Jack, you want to put that phone number out there for again for him? The number you put out, the 773
sure.
number? Go right ahead.
Yes, sir. Yep. The number is 773-273-9452.
Let's say it again slower.
Yep.
Let's say it one more time. 773.
One more time. Yep. 773-273-9452.
And is there any charge or any charge for this test? And does a person, if they're in a certain health plan, do they need referral to come to get the test? And their HMO or something like that?
To study, you essentially would be a voluntary research participant. And all those questions, our study team can help you answer. You just give us a call. There's no charge to participate in the study. It's a voluntary study, and the results will be communicated to you as a research subject, research participant.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Mason, I wanted to ask one more question.
Go right ahead.
So I took I've taken the colonoscopy before, came back okay. Had two polyps, but they said they weren't big enough anything to worry about. And I, you know, as far as the PSA, I know you heard you talk about the PSA. By me getting older now, my PSA has elevated, so my urologist gave me a PHI to take a PHI test to look for any possibility, any lesions or tumors. I do that every 6 months, and he said he's not worried about that right now either. So I was wondering, when I did the CA for my insurance to get more insurance, the insurance company, Prudential, I think it was at the time, they said, well, you know, we go by the CEA, and like my primary doctor said, no, I don't put a lot of basis on the CSA. He felt the way you did. It's not conclusive enough to say that you have this or that. With that test, that CEA. So,
do the follow up and see what happens with the genetic testing. Mm-hmm. Because it's not, we're learning, and I'm sure this will help learn even get more information. And you know, you take care of yourself, brother. I know who this is. Thank you so much for calling, and for all these years of being right there. I appreciate you so much.
Yeah, I appreciate it.
You have a blessed rest of your day. All right. Do we have another caller? All right. Well, I mean, it's really, I think we have some good questions, Doc. I think that there's some things that that people need to understand, because there's so much information out and it's so easy to get things confused. So what has been your experience with, since you, I don't know if you've done enough of these to get to this kind of patient that we've been talking about. But how do you counsel those patients? I know you say we want to go back with the standard, but what you're doing is beyond the standard. So let's talk about that, and because people want to make sure that they're doing the best thing for themselves.
Yeah, and this is actually something I'm actually really excited to talk about. I truly feel that the way we've approached, let's say, prevention and a lot of our in a lot of the ways of health, right? I think I was thinking about this show yesterday and what I would potentially compare to. You know, it's really been remarkable, I think, let's say in heart disease, right, in cardiology. When I was in medical school, we used to talk about risk criteria. We would talk to patients about, well, you're over the age of 40, you have high blood pressure, you have high cholesterol, you smoke, so we think you're at high risk for heart disease, and so we want you to take, you know, a cholesterol pill and a baby aspirin, maybe, right? And patients can probably do that, right? And we know those pills have side effects. But today, right, now we have much better ways to not just say, hey, you're at risk for heart disease, but now we can run a quick, scan of your heart. We can look at it by an ultrasound, or we can look at it by, a coronary calcium score, looking at the CT of the blood vessels. And I feel like in those situations, you can really help people out by just saying, hey, look, you're not just at risk, but we are starting to see the earliest signs of heart disease happening. And for me, not as a doctor, but also as a patient, right, that resonates with me a lot more, right? I mean, do you think that if people see like an early red flag, they're going to be more likely to take care of themselves? I mean, that's what I believe. And I don't know, do you think that's something your listeners in your years doing the show, I think would agree with, or?
Well, I think that we're always trying to look to understand things. And I'm going to take it one step further. As you know, I'm a retired urologist, but since that time, I've been doing a lot of stuff looking at the power of food, both negatively and positive. And I'm convinced that probably one of the major risk factors for the diseases that we have in America, especially, is food. The things we eat and we drink. And if we really want to do something to decrease our risk factors, and be interesting to see if tests would show that this is true, that we need to try and deal with those risk factors that are already modifiable, like smoking. You don't have to smoke. Drinking milk. You don't have to drink milk. Eating so much meats and what have you that contain, or eating things that contain bad cholesterol. You don't have to do that. So I think that people really want to be as healthy as they possibly can and get the best usage out of these kinds of tests and others, is that always first work on the stuff that's the easiest modifiable risk factor. And I by your comment on that, all my listeners know that I've had my own journey, and with the eating of a porterhouse steak every day for a long time, bought me a trip to the cardiac cath lab. And I have people know it's not that I have a problem with my heart. I have problems with the blood vessels that feed the heart. So when people talk about heart disease, you got to understand it's really not the heart. That's later. The disease is in the blood vessels that carry the blood. And that's what we've got to start thinking about. How do you modify those things upstream, which I've been doing since then, because over the last 12 years, if it walks, hops, crawls, swims, got eyes, a mom and a daddy, I don't eat it.
Dr. Mason, I was going to ask you, was it that trip to the cath lab that made you change, or
absolutely,
did you change before that?
No. Mm-hmm. It was the results from the trip to the cath lab. And the reason I had to go in the first place, because I had chest pain. Chest pain. And I was a walking time bomb, and I was a physician, and it was probably worse because my lifestyle was horrible, not sleeping much, doing all kinds of stuff. I don't want to get into all that, but all I want to just say to the people are that whatever things you have within your control to modify, to improve your health, that's important. So eating better, you can control. And getting activity, you can control. And so it's also important to do those things. So did you want to add to that, Dr.
Sullivan? Yeah, and actually, that's where I sincerely believe that for cancer right now, this is an oversimplification, but we basically have two things, right? We have screening tests for a certain number of cancers, right? A handful of them, not all of them. And then we basically have, you come in with a symptom and the cancer's already there. And I feel like you had a wake-up call, a red flag, right? Where you had chest pains, you went to the cath lab, and you knew that there was a process happening in the blood vessels feeding the heart before the heart got damaged. You were able to turn things around. My sincere hope and things I'm actively working on at UIC is, can we figure out a way for people who don't have the ability to get screening, right? Is there a way we can give them that wake-up call so they can make that lifestyle change? They can stop smoking. they can exercise more, they can eat better. You know, it's funny you mentioned processed foods, or at least, you know, not eating well. You know, I think very recently I was coming across a couple of articles showing that processed foods are a big risk factor for the types of cancers I treat. So my goal actually is to really empower patients and give them the ability.
You want to tell us those?
So people have been talking about, I think, processed foods and colon cancer, right? Like high salt and like things that are, that are like nitrite and things like processed foods, like sausages, et cetera. That's been known for colon cancer for a while, that association. Actually, last month, and this is from the American Society of Clinical Oncology, and they put out a bulletin saying that higher consumption of ultra-processed foods, you know, things that are like really refined and processed, you know, beef jerky and fast foods and things like that, they're now associating them with things like head and neck cancer, so cancers of the mouth and the throat, and also the esophagus, which is that pipe that connects your mouth to your stomach, right? And this is something that came out from a study, international study, and I think these are things that are, you know, I'm seeing a lot in my patients too. Like, I haven't made that link, and we certainly haven't gone about preventing it, but it's now becoming more and more appreciated that if you eat a lot of canned foods, processed foods, fast foods, that it's not just colon cancer now we have to worry about. It's basically everything in the digestive tract. So, this was a bulletin put out November 29th of the last year, and it came out in a study in the European Journal of Nutrition. And it's basically showing that risk factor there. So would it be great if we had a blood test or some kind of test that would say, hey, we have a signal of early, you know, esophageal cancer or oral cavity cancer or colon cancer, and maybe that person, if they couldn't find the cancer in the body, maybe that test result would make them switch to a healthier lifestyle. You know, wouldn't that be interesting? Wouldn't that be a way to prevent potentially that person? And maybe their family members too, who ate the same diet.
You know what? I think and I love that idea. And I like to take it the next step further. And for people who do that, make that change for that reason or any other, to measure the signal to see if it's any, did it change? Once the dietary plan was put in place, and I run around with a lot of guys like Dean Ornish and Caldwell Esselstyn and Mike Greger, and all these people have been talking about this forever and ever, and all my listeners will tell you that I don't get out of a show without talking about the impact of food, and unfortunately we got to understand that our system is incentivized to manage disease. That's what it's incentivized to do. That's how all the reimbursements for doctors, hospitals, and what have you, they're incentivized to manage disease. And so there's not a real, I remember when the International Institute on Cancer talked about 8 strips of bacon increase what the rate in colorectal cancer that was. And we went around trying to get bacon taken out of bacon and hot dogs taken out of cafeterias, including the one I was working at, and that was county, and others. But we've got to couple that with the kind of education that gets people to understand it's not about we're depriving you of the things that hurt you, but what we're trying to do is get you to understand that there is another way that you need to look at these things. And I think your test, especially if it could show a difference in those two groups of people, that would be helpful, I think.
I think so too. My long-term goal, you know, Dr. Mason, is try to figure out a way where it would be great if people basically just didn't take get cancer in the first place because they all lived the lifestyle that would lower that risk. But I think to get to that point, I do think that whether it's a test or, you know, some algorithm that looks at an image of the lungs or the colon, something that helps people understand that this part of your body isn't healthy, and it's at risk of cancer. And then, so why don't we make those changes? And then you can then see the results, right? People like seeing results. And as you said, we like to manage disease in the healthcare system. What I'm trying to hopefully do as an oncologist and, you know, as an internist is, can we try to capture this pre-malignant state or the state before cancer and manage that pretty well and get people back on the right path. And hopefully these tests will get better and will be something that's a little bit better than just yes or no. Maybe there will be an in between. But I do hope that we need something, right? I like to look at results when I prescribe something for patients, and I myself was a patient. You know, I like to see the results of the medicine or whatever lifestyle change I've made. So anything we can do to, I think, to help that technologically, I think it's going to empower patients to do the right thing and make the right choices. So I think that's going to be the future if we are going to, you know, get to that next inflection point and really curbing down deaths from cancer and other diseases for that matter. So, yeah.
Well, I want to thank you so much. Let's put your number out. Give your number twice more so people can get your
All
number
right.
as we're in the last couple of minutes of the show.
Sure thing. So this is for the Pathfinder 2 study that is being carried out at the University of Illinois Cancer Center. And if you're interested in participating, the number to dial is 773-273-52. Again,
two more times.
773-273-9452. Okay, and then one last time, 773-273-9452. This is for the...
Let me give you another thing, Dr. Sagan. One of the things I'd love to do is probably come by and sit down with you. And as we talk about people who do make this serious dietary improvement, looking at some things before and after. It may not be part of your protocol now, but at least to have a conversation about where we may be able to do something in the future. Not so
absolutely. Absolutely. Now, we've got some other studies going on at University of Illinois Cancer Center. I'd like to share them with you. Some of them I actually do think we could come in with an intervention and look at the before and after. So love to have that conversation.
I look forward to it. I want to thank you and the University of Illinois Cancer Center for making this possible. Thank you, Deidre. And I look forward to our next first Monday so we can, I mean, first Sunday so that we can have more conversations. Thank you so, so much, Dr. Saladin. I really appreciate what you guys are doing, and I do plan to come over because there's some other activity over at the Cancer Center I want to get involved in and see how I can help. So until next week at the same time and station, guys, I want to thank you for listening. Thank you for all your questions. Thank you for passing the information on. We really appreciate it. This is about you and your health, so take advantage of it. And until next week at the same time, may God continue to bless each and every one of you with continued health and strength as I leave you at peace. The next voice you're going to hear is Ms. Pam Morris-Walton coming to make a joyful noise over the radio. And until next week, be safe, be careful, and be thoughtful about the things that you do. Thank you for listening.